Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotte in Washington, D.C.
The civil society call for the mass protest all falls within a strategy to defeat the arbitrary decision that they made.
Civil society and opposition parties call for protests this week against delayed elections in Togo.
One, we need electoral reforms which are genuine, which allow for free expression, civic participation, and choices to be made freely by the Ugandan citizenry.
A Ugandan human rights defender says genuine electoral reforms is key to broadening the space for democracy in the East African country.
France, President Macron just actually recently issued an apology for not being able to stop the genocide that was happening.
And Rwanda commemorates 30 years since genocide Sunday. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Togo, civil society and opposition parties are calling for protests this week against delayed legislative and regional elections. This after they rejected a recent constitutional amendment that approves of a parliamentary system of governance to replace the current presidential system. They condemn the move as a constitutional coup by the ruling party aimed at ensuring that President Faure Gnassingbe stays in power for years to come. But supporters of the ruling party have dismissed the accusation, saying the opposition parties are to blame for boycotting the last parliamentary elections. The presidency announced the coming April 20 parliamentary and regional polls are postponed but gave no new date for the vote. Farida Bemba Namburema is the director of the Togolese Civil League. She tells me that citizens will not accept the delay, which she contends undermines the constitution.
The civil society call for the mass protest all falls within a strategy to defeat the arbitrary decision that they made, but also resisting and defying the regime which has made it impossible for Togolese citizens over the past years to exercise their freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, and freedom of the press. Because Togo, under the rule of Faure Gnassingbe, has systematically banned any form of gathering in our country since 2018, following the 2017 uprising that saw hundreds of thousands of Togolese citizens protest for months. So it's been years since we have had any major protest. And the regime, the day after they modified the constitution on March 25th, the following day on the 26th, they deployed soldiers all over the country and prevented opposition parties and civil society organizations from holding a meeting in response to their action.
If you are calling for this protest and the protests have been banned in Togo, don't you think you will be endangering the lives of Togolese, calling them to come out knowing very well that there's a likelihood that security might prevent this from happening?
Well, you need to understand that in face of repression, citizens must resist. You know, when you look at the history of the United States, for example, it is not because protests were banned that civil resistance activists didn't fight back by organizing protests. So it is not the first time in history that we see citizens resisting against such state capture and resisting to defend their right. Yes, we do anticipate some form of violence coming from the regime, but in the end, we cannot sit down and be idle and watch them continue depriving us of our fundamental rights. So we have to fight back. But then we are also leading the struggle at the diplomatic front, at the media front, at the geostrategic front, and also at the frontiers of the masses.
Farida, what do you say to those who are of the opinion that the opposition political parties are themselves to blame by boycotting the last parliamentary elections, which eventually led to a majority of the ruling party having a representation in parliament?
That criticism actually emanates from a complete ignorance of Togo's political history. what is happening now has absolutely nothing to do with the presence or the absence of the opposition in parliament. Let me remind you that in Article 59 of the same constitution they are tampering with, it is clearly stated that they cannot change the regime of the governance. They cannot elongate or change the duration of a presidential term unless they submit it to a referendum. So it is not even the right or the mandate of the parliament to modify the regime. They cannot decide that we move from a presidential system to a parliamentary system without submitting it to the referendum. So if we had the opposition in this current parliament, it still wouldn't make a difference because, number one, they are, like usual, going to be outnumbered by the regime cronies. And then, number two, they don't even have the mandate to make such constitutional changes in the first place. They have violated the constitution of Togo by doing such change. And the second point that I want to make is that the current parliament, their mandate expired since January 7, 2024. According to our constitution, the parliament is supposed to be removed exactly 1 week towards the end of their legislature. Their legislature ended on December 31st, 2023. So based on the constitution, 7 days later, precisely January 7th, 2024, they have absolutely no mandate whatsoever to issue any form of legislation whatsoever, no matter how minor it is. And finally, let me conclude by reminding those critics about the conditions that led to the opposition boycotting those parliamentarian elections in the first place. In 2019, when these elections were held, it was held in the aftermath of the 2017 and 18 political crisis, which saw hundreds of thousands of Togolese citizens protest for months, demanding the reinstatement of the initial 1992 constitution, which we voted for in the referendum by over 97% of the suffrage. That protest led to a regional dialogue, a country dialogue, that was mediated by the ECOWAS, with the current president of Ghana, Nana Akufo-Addo, being the head mediator of that national dialogue.
Farida Bemba Namburema is the director of the Togolese Civil League. She spoke with me from the Togolese capital, Lome. Ngosa Mulenga Simachela is one of the candidates seeking to become the president of the Law Association of Zambia, or LAZ. She is described by her supporters as a leader who puts service above herself, someone who is committed to the legal profession and a team player. This as the Law Association plans to hold elections to choose representatives to lead the group. If elected, Simachela, who is the current vice president of the organization, will take over from outgoing president Lungisani Zulu. For more about her electoral prospect, plans and vision for the Law Association, I reach Nkosena Mulenga Simachela in the Zambian capital, Lusaka.
It is correct that I'm running for the presidency of the Law Association of Zambia. I have been serving LAZ for a number of years. I've risen through the ranks from being an ordinary council member to serving as treasurer and looking after the LAZ finances, and then vice president, and now running for top office. So I'm just very passionate about relevance of the legal profession, both to itself, among the members, and to society. And I believe that that's where the future of the legal profession is, and that's the direction I'd like to play a part.
Ngosa, the question a lot of people are asking is, what is the motivation behind your decision to want to step into this big shoe as president of the Law Association of Zambia, or LAZ?
My motivation only is service. That's all I've ever done for the association is serve. It is just giving of my capabilities and my time to serve my fellow professionals in the association.
Do you think you have a groundswell of support among your colleagues in the Law Association that will propel you to victory?
I believe so. Otherwise, I wouldn't be doing this. I believe that the support is there, coupled with the abilities and skills that I bring to the table.
But you know, there are other contestants. So what makes you sure, or what do you think your electoral prospects are?
I mean, with every election, there are two possibilities. You either win or you lose. And I believe that the prospects are fair. I'm coming with a wealth of experience in terms of what is needed to propel the legal profession forward. So I think that I am in a position to win. Otherwise, I wouldn't be trying. I wouldn't be giving it a shot.
What is your vision for the Law Association of Zambia?
My vision, like I was saying earlier, is a legal profession that is relevant to its members. It's a legal profession that's relevant to society. It's a legal profession that has a voice. And we must also be balanced in the terms of, in the way that we do our work as a legal profession. So we are balanced in that we are internal facing and looking after the welfare of our members, particularly new entrants, junior members. They have particular challenges. So I believe that we need to focus on the particular challenges facing the various ranks of the profession. We're looking at sustainability of practicing in Zambia or law firms in Zambia. So we need to address some of those challenges.
If members of the association or LAS decide to give you the mandate to become the president, what should be their expectations of you?
The expectation is that my leader will bring a bold LAS, a bold voice for the legal profession, a balanced approach in the way that we do our work, and a better placed Law Association of Zambia.
What would be your message to the people of Zambia ahead of this contest, and particularly for women in Zambia?
This is it's a very important point, I think, in our history. Women have offered themselves before to lead, and it's always it's a brave choice for a woman. So I think that my message is that allow capable women to lead, focus on their capabilities and what they bring to the table. That's an environment that favors capable women to lead.
Ngoza Mulenga Simachela is the Vice President of the Law Association of Zambia. She spoke with me from the Zambian capital, Lusaka. In Uganda, the executive director of the Foundation for Human Rights Initiative says genuine electoral reforms that allow for the free participation of citizens is key to broadening the space for democracy in the East African country. Attorney Livingston Sewanyana also says a new report showing democratic decline in Uganda is a true reflection of what's happening on the ground. Those findings are confirmed by a 2023 Democracy Index study by the Economist Intelligence Unit. The East African country is rated 99 out of 167 nations around the world. It also placed 19 out of 54 African countries. But the government dismissed the findings, saying they are not accurate. Attorney Livingston Sewanyana tells me that more needs to be done to strengthen democracy in Uganda.
For quite some time, we have been experiencing a democratic backlash, more so since the 2021 elections, largely attributed to restrictions on freedoms of expression, poor accountability on the part of the state, as well as limited civic participation in policy making. Civic space for quite some time has been restricted. If you compare it to the 1990s, there is less freedom to exercise, to criticize, and also to make informed choices.
But Mr. Livingston, the last time VOA spoke with President Museveni, he dismissed these suggestions that the civic space is narrow now, because people are criticizing, people are freely expressing their views as enshrined in the Ugandan constitution. So it's not wholly true that this is happening. What do you say to that?
I don't entirely agree with him. I think the nature of expression that people are enjoying is very tokenistic. It is no longer possible for you to have public meetings where you openly criticize. As an NGO, for example, it is no longer that easy for you to make inroads into public policy. No wonder there is generally a high degree of silence on various civic matters from civil society actors. But overall, of course, we can credit the government for some degree of relative stability. But in terms of civic and political freedoms, if we go by what happened in 2021 elections, one will argue that Ugandans don't have the freedoms they used to enjoy in the past. For example, the 2021 elections, there was total shutdown of the internet.
The Ugandan government has dismissed the report findings with Dr. Chris Baryamunsi, the Information and Communication Technology and National Guidance Minister, describing it as the handiwork of armchair academicians and researchers. He was quoted as saying that these people just sit in their air-conditioned offices in the Western world and start assessing countries when they have not physically reached those countries to see the democratic culture which is prevailing, pretty much denying that this is not a true reflection of what is going on the ground.
I think the Honourable Minister, he seems to parade a general script, that tendency to dismiss whatever comes out as Western leaning and imperialistic and armchair. The facts are that if you went around the countryside, there's very limited freedom to express, and there is generally a sense of despondence and fear of what the future holds. So I think he really needs to wake up and understand that the reality is different.
So what do you think can happen that would help improve the upward trend of democracy in Uganda as a human rights defender?
I think there have been quite a number of proposals made to broaden the space. One, we need electoral reforms which are genuine, which allow for free expression, civic participation, and choices to be made freely by the Ugandan citizenry. There is a need for genuine efforts to fight poverty. There is also a need to promote public accountability among the political elite. There tends to be a deepening of corruption within the public realm. And I think to a large extent, there is also need to adopt liberal policies as well as remove legal restrictions where they exist, so that people feel free and can actually make informed choices. Much of the despondence that we're experiencing and the decline has a lot to do with elections that we normally hold, because they tend to be characterized by abuse and, of course, exchange of negative expression. And they often create a lot of discomfort within the public. And there, and after an election, there is a lot of polarization of society, to the extent that some people are subdued and they prefer to remain silent on all matters. So if those could be addressed, I think would be on the right trajectory to democratic deepening.
Attorney Livingston Sewanyana is the executive director of the Foundation for Human Rights Initiative. He spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. In the DRC, a leading women's rights activist and founder and executive director of Aid Profen is hailing the appointment of Judith Suminwa as the country's first female prime minister. Pasi Mubalama says the appointment is a significant boost toward gender equality, which she adds has become an inspiration to women across the country. Her remarks come after President Felix Tshisekedi appointed Suminwa as the prime minister in a move many analysts say took the country by surprise. Local media says Suminwa, who was a minister of planning last year, is an accomplished economist who also worked with the UN. Pasi Mubalama tells me that Suminwa's appointment will encourage women to engage in politics and to be part of the decision-making process.
I was so happy when I've heard about the fact that she has been appointed as the first female prime minister in the DRC. So in our history, this is the first time. I'm so happy as the president has taken into account the fact that women have to participate in the decision-making position. And this is the highest position in the country. And as a human rights activist, a women rights defender, it's something for which I'm really grateful for.
She has been described as competent, intelligent, and capable. How significant is this choice?
Yeah, I think it's incredible the way she has been the Minister of Plan, and also I think she has been doing a lot in terms of what she was doing as the Plan Minister. I think she has been appointed as the Prime Minister because she's competent, and this is really very important. I think for the President it was a very important choice because we have many men who are also competent, but I think have the choice on women, that was something important for us.
In your work, do you think this will be a boost for women participation in active politics, not only in Goma but the rest of the country, looking at her as a significant and important figure?
Yeah, of course, because she will be like an example, a model for so many other women and girls we are working with, and the one we are pushing for their political participation. So having a female prime minister is very important, as she's an inspiration for many of us, for many other women here. And I think we have so many challenges for women political participation, especially regarding customs and traditions, which show that women are weak and they are not so strong enough. But I think today we have something to say, that we have a first female prime minister, and this is not something small. It's a big deal. It's something very important for us to have her as the first female prime minister of the Democratic Republic of the Congo.
You talked about challenges. Congo is confronted with a lot of challenges, including the insecurity in the eastern part of the country. What are your expectations of her, and what is your message to the people of Congo following this choice as the first female prime minister?
I know it's a very tough time. As she's appointed, when we are facing the M23 rebellion here in the Eastern Congo, I know we have so many internal displaced people living in IDP's camp, and where most of women and girls are victims of sexual violence in different IDPs came. But for me, having a female prime minister, I'm expecting that as a woman, she can understand better the situation those women are facing in IDP's camp, and she can do her best to find the solution, especially to end this conflict, which unfortunately is responsible of so many human rights violations. So we are expecting a lot in terms of realization, the change she can bring. I know women are not only her first priority, but I think as a woman, she will understand better the situation of women, and she will get involved in trying to find a sustainable solution to this conflict in the region.
Percy Mubalama is a leading women's rights activist and founder and executive director of Aid Profin. She spoke with me from Goma in the DRC. Sunday, one of the darkest episodes of late 20th century occurred. More than 800,000 men, women and children were killed in Rwanda, the vast majority being ethnic Tutsis, but moderate Hutus were also murdered. The landlord country was rebuilt under the rule of President Paul Kagame, but the trauma of genocide still lingers today. Nola Haynes, political science professor at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service and a member of the International Security Advisory Board, explains to VOA's Carol Van Dam that at the time, Americans were being fed a certain narrative about African countries.
You know, interestingly enough, France, President Macron just actually recently issued an apology for not being able to stop the genocide that was happening. I was very young when it was going on, but we were all aware of it. If people were talking about it, and then a subsequent movie was made about it, and I really think that it was one of the first times, you know, Americans actually heard this word genocide. We heard of African children needing help. There were tons of commercials about, you know, feeding African children, but the idea of a genocide and the fact that it was state sanctioned and it was Hutu against Tutsi, all of those words were new to Americans. And during that time, we just did not have a strategic interest in Rwanda. I'll just be blunt about it. The U.S. has to have a strategic interest in any sort of state to intervene.
It was pointed out to me that also there were other things going on at that time, you know, in the 90s, when it was not that long after Somalia and Black Hawk Down. And it was also, you know, when Yugoslavia was being torn apart. Did that weigh into the Clinton administration's calculus of not getting involved?
I think so. We have to really address the ugly past of the way in which Americans typically thought of the continent, especially 30 years ago, to your point about Somalia. But the narrative that was being told in the United States was about this evil place where America, you know, where the Black Hawk was under attack, and the harrowing situation with American soldiers. So the narrative with the continent was not a positive one. And then I cannot stress enough, you know, the idea of having to feed African children. I distinctly remember commercial after commercial painting a picture of the continent that it was constantly in, you know, it was destitute, and we had to constantly send money to help the continent out because it couldn't help itself. And that was the narrative that was being painted of the continent, and definitely what happened in Somalia did not help. At that time, you know, if you were talking about Somalia, you were talking about, you know, pirates and all the evil doings that were going on then. And unfortunately, a lot of those stereotypes, we're still dealing with it today. While our partnerships are a lot stronger with African states today, we are still dealing with stereotypes about the African continent.
Nola, have we learned any lessons since 30 years ago, since this happened, about the danger of genocide? I mean, when you look around today, what's happening in the world?
Right. And, you know, obviously, you know, we're talking about Israel and Gaza here, which is definitely a situation where Gazans are just being wiped out. We don't know the exact number, but there are some numbers that are actually reaching over 100,000. And the images that we're seeing of children being affected by, you know, the constant bombardments. And unfortunately, Hamas definitely bears a lot of the weight here in terms of putting their own people at risk. But I will say that does not give Israel the right to kill civilians. You know, with the latest national security memo that outlined what the U.S. designates as human rights violations. We are waiting for, you know, the report there. I would say we are in a moment of pivot. I mean, you've heard from the vice president very clearly, you know, if things don't change, then we have to change our posture towards Israel after 70 years. And that is not a small thing.
Nola Haynes is a political scientist at Georgetown University and a member of the International Security Advisory Board. She spoke with my colleague Carol Van Dam from Washington.
According to World Economic Forum, an estimated 100 million people in Africa suffer from clinical depression, and 66 million of them are women. On this week's edition of Our Voices, we'll seek to understand more about depression, which has been described as the most prevalent mental illness in the world. Join the conversation Wednesdays at 1900 UTC on The Voice of America.
The U.S. Trade Office says American firms are losing out on business and contracts in Kenya due to bribe requests and extortion from top government officials. A new report released this week warns that ultimately corruption will hurt foreign investment in the East African nation. For VOA, Mohammed Yusuf has more from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
According to the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative, American businesses are finding it hard to secure Kenyan government contracts meant to develop the country because senior government officials ask for a bribe before awarding such jobs. The 2024 National Trade Estimate Report on Foreign Trade Barriers, released last week, said that the contracts are going mainly to foreign firms willing to pay their demanded bribes. This level of corruption, say the authors of the report, will cause Kenya to lose future investment from businesses and countries that shun or punish corrupt activities. Cleophas Malala is the Secretary General of Kenya's ruling party. He admits Kenya's procurement and payment have been a problem, but says President William Ruto and the government are working to solve the problem.
We know it's a challenge to us, but the president is keen in fighting corruption. You've seen how hard he has been. You remember he moved very swiftly when the KEMSA saga came up. He has been steadfast in ensuring that any public officer who gets involved in corrupt activities relinquishes his position and he faces the rule of law. As a political party, we've said time and again that we are not going to defend anybody.
KEMSA is Kenya's Medical Supplies Authority. A corruption scandal involving a $28 million contract last year led to the dismissal of the agency's top officials. According to a survey by Kenya's Ethics and Anti-Corruption Commission, the country's interior, health and transport ministries rank as the most corrupt. The survey showed that the size of the average bribe doubled in 2023. Kenyan activist Boniface Mwangi told VOA, Americans are not asking anything new, but these are normal requests.
In this country, it's very rare for you to get a government tender or any work without paying a bribe. Kenyans pay bribes every day, not because they want to, but because they're forced to. If you don't apply for an ID, you need to pay a bribe. You go to the police, you want them to investigate a crime, you pay a bribe. You want to go ask for a passport, you pay a bribe. We're a bribe nation. And if you look at the Chinese, one of the reasons the Chinese succeed in this country very well in doing business because they're able to pay to play. So they pay government officials and they get tenders. So the Americans are not being told to do something that is not common. They've been asked to do what is the norm in this country, that corruption is a way of life in our country.
Last year, the Anti-Corruption Commission said the lack of transparency, accountability and public participation in some government projects create a breeding ground for corruption. That aligns with the U.S. Trade Office report, which said American firms complained of excessive complexity and inefficiency in the procurement process for contracts. Manala says the government is working to change some of the procurement laws to help fight corruption and allow investors to compete fairly.
It is important for us to relook into certain clauses and which our government is trying to work on, is to relook into clauses that become an impediment in implementation of or in the procurement process. We would want to ensure that all our investors get justice when it comes to the procurement system.
Kenya finished low on the Transparency International Corruption Rankings for 2023, ranking 126th out of 180 countries measured for perception and prevalence of corruption. Mohammed Yusuf, VOA News, Nairobi.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Samson O'Malley. That will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs, and music from our African collection. But first, it's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Samson O'Malley. Hello, Samson.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. The stage is set for an electrifying climax in the CAF Champions League, as the semi-finalists have been decided after thrilling quarterfinal matches at the weekend. Four teams have emerged as title contenders for the 2023-2024 edition of the Africa's flagship club competition, with South African club Mamelodi Sundowns, Al Ahly of Egypt, DR Congo side TP Mazembe, and Esperance of Tunisia reaching the last four. All the four sides that emerged following the conclusion of the quarterfinals on Saturday are former champions, setting the stage for captivating semi-final encounters. In a terse battle that went down to the wire, Mamelodi Sundowns of South Africa secured their spot in the semi-finals in a controversial manner after edging past Young Africans in a penalty shootout. Mamelodi Sundowns head coach Rulani Mokwena reacts to their victory over the Young Africans.
Very proud of the players, very proud of the technical team, they're very proud of the football club. We struggled with in the first leg, and I thought maybe the lack of preparation time worked to our demise, you know, because we didn't have enough days to prepare for the first leg. And then if you don't put in a bit more of an aggressive offensive performance away from home and with an away goal, the home fixture becomes a little bit tricky.
The semi-final pairings have been determined, with TP Mazembe set to face Al Ahly, while Esperance will lock hands with Mamelodi Sundowns. The first leg matches of the semi-finals will be played on the weekend of 18th of April, with the second leg matches scheduled to be played a week later. Staying with football news, Namibia's national futsal team coach Ryan Jago is determined to get the team to qualify for its first ever Futsal World Cup, scheduled for Uzbekistan in September 2024. For the team to qualify, they must finish among the top three in the upcoming Futsal Africa Cup of Nations, scheduled to take place in Morocco next Thursday. And Coach Jago is ready for the challenge.
As a nation, we can now grow the grassroots side of the game and really build the local leagues, and hopefully gain a good following. The better we do, the more children will fall in love with it.
In athletics, Africa and Commonwealth 100 meters champion Ferdinand Omanyala and world 800 meters champion Miriam Mora are among the 24 athletes named to represent Team Kenya at the World Athletics Relay set for May 4th to the 5th in Nassau, Bahamas. Athletics Kenya named a squad of 15 men and 9 women after the conclusion of nationals trials held on Saturday at the Nyanyo National Stadium. Omanyala sprinted the last portion of the 4x100 meters relay to affirm the team's dominance in the race.
Next week we need to make a very firm team, not just in training, not just physicality, but also the mental aspects and the cohesion that we'll have in the team. So we're going to be brothers for the next 3 weeks.
And that's it for this week's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Samson. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's One Man's Point of View with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under-Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Now that the people of Senegal have elected a new president, Bassirou Sayé, and he became the fifth democratically elected president of Senegal, well-wishers of Senegal and its people should wish them much progress. Of course, the elections in Senegal was remarkable in many ways. At one point, it felt that Senegal would lose its credential for peaceful transfer of power. Then, with the resistance of the people, the elections were held enough to make it possible for the new president to be inaugurated on time. So we must extend our congratulations once more to the people of Senegal. Now that the elections have been held, now that the people of Senegal have shown their determination to hold on to the democratic regime, the difficult task starts now. Some analysts in Senegal have noted that if you combine the two leading votes, that is the winner and the runner-up, the election could be regarded as a judgment or referendum on the old regime in Senegal. Also, the elections were held almost in a carnival atmosphere, dancing, no problem, and one by one, the candidates withdrew and accepted the result even before the counting was over. And finally, the runner-up, when he realized that the winner had achieved more than 50%, gracefully accepted the result and conceded, thus following the pattern that had been established in Liberia. Of course, those who have followed the party of Mr. Sankar, to which the president belonged, will have no doubt as to what their program is going to be. The symbol of the broom tells us that the party or movement hopes to sweep clean the political landscape of Senegal. That's why many were waiting to hear what the new president would say at the inauguration. He did limit himself to few remarks, and perhaps it took his supporters by surprise when the first thing he said was that Senegal has had good relationship with France, and that his government would wish to maintain that. But he soon pivoted to what is the real new element. He said that while maintaining good relations with France and perhaps many of the Western world, Senegal will look to have relations with other partners. And he added also that the litmus test would be the partner or partners that can produce results very quickly. Any sophisticated analyst should be able to see that what he was trying to say is that hitherto donors, Senegal, channel carefully the Bretton Woods institution, where the process is slow and to many burdensome. And that's why he said there will be others who will have quick deliveries, quick results. And it makes some sense, because the backbone of Mr. Sankar's party and that of the president, the youth of Senegal, who have been burdened for a long time by high unemployment. And this may well be the first agenda for the new government, trying to reduce youth unemployment. And not just reducing unemployment, but the creation of good-paying jobs that will be fit to live on. So in general, what the new government of Senegal was trying to convey is what many African countries and many in the Global South have been saying, that the people of African continent must be respected for making their own choices. And they felt this could only happen if there was mutual respect by partners as well as having a decent respect for their choices. And there you have a major play taking place. The government, it seems, wants to be balanced in its relationship. Even though they are going to sweep the country clean, they do not want to throw the baby with the bath, but to use thoughtfulness and pragmatism. I thank you.
And that was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Joner, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from our collection.
Oh, baby, come here. Oh,
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here, the English to Africa service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know, by now we are on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, including producer Nicole Peters and engineer Justin Thwaite the Great, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, an empty belly has no ears. I'm your host, Peter Clotet in Washington. Good evening, Africa.